I'm reading from Matthew 9, starting at verse 35. This passage is full of good news, but also a warning. Jesus went throughout all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every disease and every affliction. When he saw the crowds, he had compassion for them because they were harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. Then he said to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, pray earnestly to the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest." And he called to him his 12 disciples and gave them authority over unclean spirits to cast them out and to heal every disease and every affliction. The names of the 12 apostles are these. First, Simon, who's called Peter, and Andrew, his brother, James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, Philip and Bartholomew, Thomas and Matthew, the tax collector, James, the son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus, Simon the zealot, and Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. Now, these 12 Jesus sent out, instructing them, "Go nowhere among the Gentiles and enter no town of the Samaritans, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, and proclaim as you go, saying, 'The kingdom of heaven is at hand.' Heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse lepers, cast out demons. You received without paying, so give without pay. Acquire no gold or silver or copper for your belt, no bag for your journey, or two tunics or sandals or a staff, for the laborer deserves his food. And whatever town or village you enter, find out who is worthy in it, and stay there until you depart. As you enter the house, greet it. And if the house is worthy, let your peace come upon it. But if it is not worthy, let your peace return to you. And if anyone will not receive you or listen to your words, shake off the dust from your feet when you leave that house or town. Truly I say to you, it will be more bearable on the day of judgment for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah than for that town."
Good morning, everybody. For those of you worried about Liam's dramatic exit, the x-rays were negative, so should be all right. Last weekend, I was in Shenandoah National Park with my mom and brothers. Mom turned 60 this year, and so we took her camping to celebrate. We started planning the trip almost a year ago, trying to work out all the details. The day this spring that the government shutdown ended, my brother was online reserving campsites. We took care of every detail we could think of, who would bring which gear, where we were going to get the food, which trails we would hike on, and it worked. We had a great trip. Everything went without a hitch. If all you like to do when you travel is camp and hike, then we would make an excellent travel agency. In our text this morning, Jesus sends the disciples out on a trip. And his travel agency does things a little differently. Right? Their motto, don't plan anything. Don't take supplies. Don't book a place to stay. Just start walking and see what happens. I like my way of traveling. So I have some questions about this text, particularly three. What, how, and why? What is this journey that Jesus is sending his followers on? How does he expect them to conduct themselves while they're on it? And most importantly, why is he doing this? Why is he putting them through it? What and how and why? So, three questions. The first one is what? What kind of journey is this? And Jesus is really clear in chapter 9 that it is a harvest journey. He is sending his followers out like migrant workers. Except instead of harvesting wheat or apples, they're going to be harvesting hearts and minds, right? This is the last three verses of chapter 9. When Jesus saw the crowds, he had compassion for them because they were harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. Then he said to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, pray earnestly to the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest." And as soon as Jesus finishes saying that, he, as the Lord of the harvest, sends out his 12 disciples as laborers into the harvest. Jesus wants the broken, confused, hurting, weary people of the world to be gathered into the kingdom of heaven. Jesus wants us lost sheep to lie down in green pastures and drink from still waters and have our souls restored. And it really is immediately that Jesus does this. There's no time delay between the end of chapter 9 and then chapter 10. Jesus, he tells his disciples to pray for laborers, and then before they can even open their mouths to ask their normal dumb disciple questions, he starts sending them out to be the laborers, which may or may not have been what the disciples would have had in mind when they prayed. They may have thought they were talking about somebody else. After all, we know how thoroughly unqualified these guys were to be laborers in Jesus' harvest. I mean, you can read any one of the Gospels, the disciples are doofuses. And at this point, they've been with Jesus a few weeks, maybe a few months. They are not the A-team. But Jesus sends them out as laborers into his harvest. If you are a follower of Jesus, then you, I hope, know how thoroughly unqualified you are to be a laborer in Jesus' harvest, to go out and proclaim the good news of the kingdom of heaven, to heal every disease and every affliction. Look, maybe you have followed Jesus for many years and you're a member of this church and you attend a Bible study every week, but the idea of going out into the world to love your neighbor and tell them about Jesus and pray and work for their spiritual and physical healing, that idea is so terrifying that you already have stored in the back of your mind a 3-page list of excuses for why somebody else is the laborer for the harvest. Maybe the idea of going out and doing this actually feels wrong to you. Feels oppressive, like you'd be imposing your opinion on other people. Maybe you have some abiding personality trait that you can't imagine overcoming. You're sarcastic and impatient. You tend to ramble every time you open your mouth. You're a world-class introvert, and you think, well, that's that. Maybe there's some sin that's crippling you and leaves you certain that you're not just an unqualified laborer, but that you've been disqualified. If you were to go out into the harvest, it would be pure hypocrisy. If any of those things are true of you, then you are exactly the kind of laborer Jesus is looking for. Jesus doesn't work with the elite, the veteran, the self-confident. Jesus works with the doubting, the downtrodden. What kind of work is Jesus looking to do? Jesus is recruiting sheep to serve as shepherds. He's looking for workers who are fools like you and me. So what kind of trip is this? It's a harvest trip staffed entirely by people who have no idea how to harvest. It's the equivalent of sending me out into a literal harvest with actual wheat. It's going to end badly, right? So how is this supposed to work? How, if we are so unqualified, and we are so unqualified? How does Jesus intend to make up for that, to compensate for our weaknesses? How are we supposed to manage on this trip when we have no idea what to do or how to do it? That's the second question. How? And the answer is, Jesus doesn't intend to make up for our weaknesses at all. Jesus intends to use our weaknesses, to expose our weaknesses, and so teach us not to rely on our weak selves. So Jesus begins his instructions in chapter 10 to his disciples how they are supposed to manage this work that they cannot do. Look at verses 9 and 10. Acquire no gold or silver or copper for your belts, no bag for your journey or two tunics or sandals or a staff, for the laborer deserves his wages. Look, this is the first century equivalent of sending you to a country where you don't speak the language and not only saying you can't have your AAA card or a spare tire, you're not allowed to take money or your phone or a map. All of those items that would be most useful, those items that would be better, best for covering up your weaknesses in that place that you don't know your way around, choose to leave all of them behind. And the reason Jesus gives, it's there in verse 10, for the laborer deserves his wages. In the first century, laborers, and particularly harvesters, worked paycheck to paycheck. You would go out into the field, you'd work all day long, and at the end of the day, you would get paid exactly enough to feed your family for a day, so that the next day you could go back out into the field and do the whole thing over again. Laborers, they didn't have a savings account, a safety net. They didn't have retirement or disability insurance or paid time off. They had to work on faith, trusting that they would be able to get through the day, and at the end of the day, they would get the wages that they had earned, the wages that they needed to survive. And Jesus says, if you're going to work for me, it's going to be like that. You're going to learn to live one day at a time, trusting that I will provide what you need for that day. Jesus wants us to be okay not always knowing the plan or the calendar or all the steps involved, trusting in him and not in our own understanding of what we expect to happen. So beware of carefully arranging your life to make every day and every circumstance manageable. That kind of arranging, it weaves an illusion of strength, of competence that hides your real weakness. That kind of arranging, it aborts real trust before that trust has a chance to be born. Brother Andrew was a follower of Jesus. He became a follower of Jesus after serving in the Dutch army in Indonesia in the 1950s. And he spent his adult life traveling behind the Soviet Union's Iron Curtain, preaching to and encouraging Christians in communist countries where the governments were violently hostile to any kind of religion. And Brother Andrew, he always traveled with a partner as they drove around so that whenever they encountered a Soviet border guard or customs official, one of them could talk to the Soviet soldier and the other one could be desperately praying that that soldier would not discover the crates of Bibles and other banned materials in the back seat of the car. It was a life that required one day at a time reliance on God. And before he set out on this life, Andrew, he went to a ministry training school in England. And this was a school that believed in Jesus' methods. And so before you could graduate, no matter how much you knew about Greek or Hebrew or theology or preaching, before you could graduate, you were sent out in a small group to spend weeks traveling around Scotland, proclaiming Jesus and serving people. And the rules were, you couldn't know anyone in the towns you were going to. You couldn't take any money. You couldn't have a map or a plan. They were Matthew 10 rules. Not to deprive people, but to teach them to trust in God. And that trust, that day-by-day trust, is what got Andrew through all those years behind the Iron Curtain. So, is your life manageable? Perhaps, without even really meaning to, you have planned everything out so that you never encounter situations that are out of control or dangerous. Perhaps you have gotten so good at avoiding difficult people you don't know what to do with that you don't even notice yourself doing it on a regular basis. Perhaps if you're a Christian, you have mastered the art of when you hear about something that is just way outside of your comfort zone saying, oh, so humbly, you know, that's just really not my gift. And then going about your business. If so, you're missing out. If so, you really are aborting the trust that Jesus wants to grow in you. By designing a life in which you appear to yourself to be strong, you prevent God from working through your weakness. And Jesus, he doesn't want us to just rely directly on him. He wants us to rely on others as well. And so he continues his how instructions in verses 11 to 13. And whatever town or village you enter, find out who is worthy in it and stay there until you depart. As you enter the house, greet it. And if the house is worthy, let your peace come upon it. But if it is not worthy, let your peace return to you. Find out who is worthy in it and stay there until you depart. Do you hear how personal and open-ended that request is? Can you picture yourself knocking on a stranger's door and saying, hi, I'm Zach. Can I stay with you for a while? Is anybody in the room comfortable with that? Are any of us at all interested in being the one asking that question, or for that matter, answering that question? And yet, this is what Jesus asks of us. Because Jesus is teaching us to trust. And he says relying on him means relying on others as well. This, brothers and sisters, I believe is a particular word for Calvin, a place where we need to grow. I find in myself this deep aversion to being in any of your debt. This instinct to make sure that if I owe any of you anything, I quickly square it and balance the books. And I know that I'm not alone in that in this room. That instinct, that aversion to debt is widespread in us. We generally expect to be able to manage our own lives. And we generally tend to feel shame if we can't. For instance, my debt aversion has me aware every day that I owe Mark and Angela Edwards. I don't see them today. I'm choosing Mark and Angela. Now, they're not the only ones. Okay. I walk by their house because they live in our neighborhood twice, three, four, five times a day. And every time I go, ugh, because we borrow their truck all the time. I raid Mark's tools. They take my kids out on their birthdays. They just kind of drop by, random little presents. And for the life of me, I can't figure out how to square the debt. And so I'm just stuck with it. And I don't like it. And what's nuts is that there are some of you where it's reversed. Some of you are in my debt. You owe me, and you can't figure out how to pay me back. And that doesn't bother me at all. I'm totally fine with that, and I would never want you to feel any shame or frustration about it. It's just, I can't be in debt. It's okay for everybody. Like you understand how ridiculous this is now that we're talking about it, but this is all of us. And in my honest moments, I have to acknowledge the only reason I think that way is because I want to believe I'm stronger than everyone else. I want to pretend I got this. It is a lie. And so Jesus sends us out in such a way as to make war against that lie. Jesus says to us, go out of your way to ask others for help, even when you could do things on your own. Don't just get to the very end of your ability to manage things and then go, I guess I'll call Mark again. Call him first. Make war on your instinct for independence. Teach yourselves to depend on each other. Rely on each other to an uncomfortable degree. So, if you're traveling somewhere and you have the choice between a hotel room and calling up an acquaintance to ask to stay with them, call the acquaintance. Look, I get it. A hotel room is simple, it's convenient, it's private. You don't have to behave like a good guest at the end of a tiring day. You don't have to feel like you're imposing on anybody, but that's not the point. The point is to learn to trust, to learn to rely on one another. Or how about this? Invite yourself over to dinner. This, if my mother listens to this sermon, and she generally listens to sermons, she's going to jump off the exercise bicycle at her gym and shout, no, Zachary, you're not supposed to do this. But it's a small version of exactly what Jesus is telling us to do. So try it a couple of times this summer. Just say, hey, how about dinner at your place? Here's one I'm terrible at. I failed on this just last week on my trip to Shenandoah. If you got a flight out of Portland, instead of paying to park a car at PDX or paying for a bus ticket, ask somebody to drive you. And if you really want to get brave, don't even offer to pay for the gas. Just say, hey, I'm going to rely on you. I'm going to trust in you. You get the idea. We have to practice relying on one another. Now, of course, we also have to be willing to help. That's assumed in this text, and praise God, it can be assumed at Calvin. This is a church full of people who are willing to help, and it is a blessing to be among you. What Jesus is nudging us toward here is learning to be willing to be helped. And that's something where we still have some growing to do. Jesus wants us to make war on our instinct for independence, to get used to having debts we will never be able to pay back, to rely on him and to rely on each other. Why? Why do we have to do this? It's going to be so uncomfortable. Even though I just gave you cover, if you try that thing where you invite yourself over to Tim's, Tim specifically, just y'all all go to Tim and Rachel. You're still going to feel deeply uncomfortable. If you go ahead and do it today while everybody still remembers, why do we have to do it? We're going to be bad at it. We're not going to like it. So what is Jesus up to? Why does he insist on us on this? That's our third question, and the answer lies buried in verses 11 to 15, and I'm not kidding, it's buried. So I'll read, and then we're going to do some digging. And whatever town or village you enter, find out who is worthy in it, and stay there until you depart. As you enter the house, greet it. And if the house is worthy, let your peace come upon it. But if it is not worthy, let your peace return to you. And if anyone will not receive you or listen to your words, shake off the dust from your feet when you leave that house or town. Truly I say to you, it will be more bearable on the day of judgment for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah than for that town. Let's start at the end. Sodom and Gomorrah is a story from the book of Genesis when two messengers from God come to this land and they look for a place to stay. In the whole area, only one person will take them in, Lot, who's a foreigner. And the rest of the people of Sodom are so mad about that that they go try to break down Lot's door and take advantage of the messengers. And as God sends these two messengers to judge Sodom and Gomorrah, God, he stays back and he has a conversation with his friend Abraham. Abraham knows what those messengers are about, and he wants to know if God will spare those wicked cities if there are just a few good, righteous people living there. Abraham and God go back and forth on this question, and eventually Abraham, he asks God, what if in the whole city there are just 10 righteous people? Then would you spare it? And God says, yes. Sadly, there aren't 10. There's just Lot, and the people don't want Lot. So God takes Lot out of the city and destroys the city. We know from the Gospel of Luke that in this episode that we've been talking about, Jesus sent out the disciples as messengers two by two to go to all these villages. So Jesus is recreating the beginning of the Sodom and Gomorrah story. Two messengers going to the village to proclaim God's word. Jesus, he sends out these messengers and he tells them to look in each village for a place to stay, for just one worthy house. And he says, if they find one, great, stay there, proclaim the good news, work for healing. But if not, they are to shake the dust from their feet and leave. So what Jesus is doing is he's doubling down on Abraham's hope that just a few righteous people can save an entire city. But Jesus, he's teaching his disciples that one righteous person, that one worthy house would be enough. You see, Jesus knows that all people everywhere live more or less the same way. Rich or poor, Western or Eastern, liberal or conservative, religious or secular, we are all ledger keepers. We all, in every relationship, have in the back of our mind a tally of the credits and debits, what I owe you and what you owe me. We hate being in the red, and so we work to avoid it. We can't help ourselves. Jesus knows this, and Jesus knows that we are all in the red, that we all owe God a debt we could never repay. I might someday, somehow, figure out how to square things with Mark and Angela. How do you repay a debt to a person when every single time you draw breath, you are breathing in an undeserved gift from that person? There is no being square with God. And there is a day of judgment coming when we will have to reckon with that unpayable debt. Those messengers that Jesus is asking us to cast our minds back to in Genesis, they were really just investigators. God sent them to learn just how big Sodom and Gomorrah's debt was. But now Jesus sends us out with a better message. You and I, we are not debt investigators. We are not God's repo men. You and I, we are heralds of grace, sent to proclaim that the kingdom of heaven is at hand. And Jesus sends us out to say that, to say there is a new way to live, a way that's not based on the ledger at all, but is based on the total commitment and boundless generosity of God. He sends us out saying, put down the ledger before it crushes you. To say you don't have to be ledger keepers anymore. Instead, you can be vessels of grace. Vessels of grace. Look at the front of your bulletin and hear one of Jesus' messengers herald the kingdom of God. Paul says, "For what we proclaim is not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord, with ourselves as your servants for Jesus' sake. For God who said, let light shine out of darkness, has shown in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. But we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that the surpassing power belongs to God and not to us. We have this treasure in jars of clay this treasure, the kingdom of heaven, the privilege of putting down the ledger and walking away from it forever, the undeserved gift of the light, of the glory, of the knowledge of God in the face of Jesus Christ. And what does Paul say about this treasure? That we have it in jars of clay. Brother, sister, you are a jar of clay. On your own, you are brittle and empty. And if you insist on keeping the ledger, then on the day of judgment, the full weight of your debt to your Maker will come crashing down on you. And you will be shattered into 1,000 pieces, never to be repaired. But the kingdom of heaven is at hand. And God is willing to forgive your debt, to crush not you, but the ledger that weighs against you, and to turn you into a vessel of grace, to use you as a messenger of grace again and again, filling you so that you can be continually poured out as a gift and a servant to those around you. But for that to work, you have to stay a jar of clay. You see? If you go out into the harvest as some dazzling chalice of gold, giving gifts but never receiving them, then you won't be a vessel of grace at all. You will be the symbol of a new kind of independence. No matter what you say about grace, the message of your life will be, you need what I have, but I don't need anything from you. Be strong like me. You won't be warring against your instinct for independence at all. You will have joined sides with the lie. And so Jesus sends you out in weakness. He has to send you out in weakness as a vessel of grace because you need grace, as a cracked and battered jar of clay whose life shows that God and God alone has the power to forgive debts, to erase the ledger. Your weakness is God's weapon in this war against independence. So stop pretending to be strong. Go ahead and practice being weak. Rely on God. Rely on others. Why wouldn't you live this way? Perhaps you, like me, are averse to unpayable debts. You already owe God an unpayable debt. Pinching pennies when it comes to your other debts is not going to change that. Or perhaps you, like me, you don't want to burden and impose on other people. You don't want to cause problems for them. But if we are vessels of grace, then in God's kingdom, in God's economy of grace, when you ask someone else for help, you're not imposing on them at all. You are inviting them into the life of grace, into a life that is freer and more generous and more lasting than any life they could have on their own, a life which is only available to the weak, to jars of clay. Brothers and sisters, God won that life for you. That life of weakness and freedom through Jesus. Jesus is the light of the knowledge of the glory of God. Jesus is the one righteous person who comes and dwells in our midst and, unlike Lot, remains with us in order that his righteousness might cover us all and our debts be erased and the ledger be left behind on the day of judgment. Jesus is the original messenger of grace, and Jesus is the entire message of grace. And Jesus sends you out as a vessel of grace to proclaim not your strength, but his power through your weakness. So put down the ledger. Practice putting down the ledger by racking up debts you could have avoided but can't repay. Go out of your way to be a vessel of grace, and as you rely on others, you will demonstrate to yourself and to them how much we all have to rely on Jesus. Kill your instinct for independence. And grow a habit of depending on God in its place. Put down the ledger and live as vessels of the endless grace of Jesus Christ.